College Football Podcast with Herbie and Pollock. Now here's your host, Kevin Negandhi.
Welcome to the College Football Podcast with Herbie and Pollock. Kevin Negandhi here with you. It is early May, and we hope wherever you are healthy and you are safe as we deal with the pandemic, with some hope on the other side, obviously, with the weather getting better and we can be outside more. And the belief that maybe football down the road is something that we will see later on in the fall. And Heather Dinich, College Football Insider, will join us to talk about the information she's gathered from commissioners throughout the sport, as well as athletic directors and coaches, and how they're approaching the unknown in a very fluid situation. We're also going to have Mel Kiper Jr. back with us, fresh off the 2020 draft, to break down who he sees as the top talent in 2021 in the draft. And that gives us an idea with his big board, some of the big stars and the big names that stand out this upcoming college football season. And also a thorough breakdown on Trevor Lawrence and Justin Fields, another quarterback that's emerging in the conversation that we'll probably be heavily discussing when it comes to the 2021 draft, as like the threesome here when it comes to quarterback play. And he gives us his thoughts on two or three sleepers, maybe the next Joe Burrow this upcoming college football season. We also want to send our thoughts to Todd McShay. We had him on the podcast a few weeks ago, and he had his battle with COVID-19. And thankfully, he is back and he's healthy. And our thoughts are with him, because it was multiple weeks of hell. And Todd details that on the Adam Schefter podcast, so you can check that out. And just, it's just glad to have our friend and our colleague back after what he went through. And now he gets to spend some time with his family. Speaking of family, I think whenever we talk about sports, we consider it part of our family, and because we love it. And sports inspire us. They give us hope in ourselves, in the world, and of course, in amazing comebacks. Our love for sports, it grows each and every day, especially now, right? And Dear Sports is our love letter to sports. I did one that we're going to play for you right now, and you could share your Dear Sports letter with us. Call 860-506-6161. That's 860-506-6161. Or share a video or text using the hashtag Dear Sports on Twitter or Instagram.
Dear Sports, man, we miss you. You've been there from the start for me as a little kid growing up and watching superstars on the big screen, going to the stadiums and the arenas and hearing the crowd. I miss that feeling. I miss that vibe. And I miss the emotions, the highest of highs at a Super Bowl, the lowest of lows at a Stanley Cup final or a World Series or an NBA final or even a Super Bowl. But each time, you deliver every single night for us, and each time we're entertained. And for me, the personal experience, it's surrounded everything I've ever done with my family. Helped me get to know my dad better. Helped me grow up with my brother and share the experiences with my mom and pass it on to the next generation with my kids and my wife each and every weekend when we're watching football. And I think about the greatest moments in my life, they're tied to family and they're tied to sports. Sharing those moments, sharing them with friends, and understanding what it's like to be disappointed, but also what it's like to feel alive and celebrate with everybody around you on a Super Bowl level stage, and also partying with people you love at a parade. Until then, we're going to just spend more time with our family, enjoy the quiet noise around us, and just count the days till we can talk about, did you see that highlight? Or I can't wait to talk about this on SportsCenter. Until then, we love you and thank you.
It's great to have Heather Dinich, College Football Insider, joining us now. And, what a time that we live in right now. It is the taping of this podcast is May 8th, so there is so much unknown The one thing that college football has an advantage is time, you know, in front of them, at least for the next 3 months, to try to figure things out and monitor a fluid situation. And Heather, you've been talking to conference commissioners. You've been talking to school ADs as well as coaches. What are you gathering right now on where we're at and not just now, but the belief of playing football in the fall?
Well, it's hard for everyone in the sport to wrap their heads around the fact that this is something they can't control, because especially the Power Five commissioners are used to being the decision makers of the sport. And this is something that while they all want to return to college football at the same time and under the same circumstances, they all recognize it just might not be possible. And everyone I've spoken to, including athletic directors, their conversations right now are all about contingency plans. What ifs? How do we handle this? And there are so many questions and models and scenarios that they are getting into, the possibility of a shortened season, a conference-only season, a spring season, you name it, they've thought about it. And then you get into the deeper dive of what happens if my coach gets COVID-19 three games into the season? What happens if we're playing a team that has a rash of infections and they can't play? Is it a forfeit? So you're talking about really big picture issues down to the nitty gritty of how do we sanitize a locker room?
That is a lot to take in. And honestly, each one is, each one's complicated. There are no easy answers for anything. And when we talk about contingency plans, is there kind of a deadline that they've set in their minds, or at least one or two commissioners or an AD has set a deadline that we need to know a certain amount of information by, let's just say, the end of June or maybe the, you know, mid-July, because then you start thinking about ramping up for camps. Is there any type of dates that they've set in their mind that we have to have an idea where we're at here?
Yes, but knowing that they're moving targets. I talked to TCU athletic director Jeremiah Donati earlier this week, and he talked about how they would really like to have some sort of a plan or anything around the June 1st date, because if you're going to start the season on time, you probably need to know that before mid-July, because the coaches and athletic directors I've talked to have said we need 6 to 8 weeks, eight being the ideal situation to get players back into physical game condition. So if the season is going to start on time, remember, you've got Notre Dame and Navy playing in Dublin, Ireland on August 29th with flights booked, hotels booked, the stadium ready, etc. If all those things are actually going to happen, then probably around the beginning of June, you need to kind of figure out where it is. But at the same time, this is not their decision. Everyone I've spoken to at the commissioner's level has told me the timetable will be decided by the coronavirus, by the governors, by the state officials, and by the medical experts. So while they might throw out something like, hey, it'd be great to know something by June 1st and really know something more by mid-July, that's just a guess. Mm-hmm. and it's not there. It's really not. It's out of their hands.
What's the approach here? And again, everything we're saying is fluid, but let's just say things do die down with the virus, considering the summertime. We continue to learn more information about how the virus is and where it can survive. And things kind of slow down, hypothetically, especially in where it's hot, you know, mm-hmm. In southern states or like in California. And students are not on campus, but there's a plan for people to return. Are they comfortable, the people that you've talked to, of having athletes on campus while students are not on campus but planning to be on campus? Like we've seen in the past where guys got a report for camp to get in shape before all the, you know, regular students hit campus and get ready for school.
Well, it literally depends on who you ask. Herm Edwards at Arizona State told me, if it's not safe for students to come back, why is it safe for my players? He said to me, I want every one of my players tested, every one of my staff members tested, and when it's safe for everyone to come back, that's when we should come back. And Clay Helton at USC told me the same thing. He said, I can't imagine a Coliseum without fans, and if it's not safe for everyone to return, then none of us should return. At the same time, there is a dire financial need within athletic departments all across the country and the sport to see college football return. So there has also been a sentiment, well, if we can get them back and we can do it safely, we should do it. Now, a lot of universities have also already committed to online learning through summer. So right there is an issue. And again, going back to who makes these decisions, it's not just elected officials and scientists. It's also university presidents. If their doors aren't open, nobody can go back, right? So there's also that aspect to it as well. And I was talking to Big 12 Commissioner Bob Bowlesby just yesterday, and he was saying they are student athletes, and we throw that term around all the time. But if they're not enrolled in online courses, then they're not students and they can't play. So what does the academic side of it look like is a huge answer to that question as to when they're going to be able to return.
I've had the chance to talk to some people, you know, throughout the sport that have talked about, you know, the dire consequences that you brought up of not having the revenue come in with college football, and not just affecting, you know, all of college sports. It'll affect the university, especially when you're still paying coaches and scholarships. Is there a concern that we will not have a season at all? When I say, is there a concern? There is, but like at what level that we won't have a season at all, even this spring?
Yes, that's certainly a concern. And when I talk to all these people, I say, what is your gut instinct about whether there will be a college football season or not? And most of them have said to me, I think we will. I think we'll play in one way, shape, or form. Is that optimistic? Is that just hope? I don't know. They're also preparing for the possibility that they start the season and this comes back. I mean, you have to remember, it took one NBA player to shut the whole thing down? That's the question they're asking. I mean, we talk about what happens if my coach gets COVID-19 during the season. Is that enough? What happens if a quarterback gets it? Somebody asked me, can my quarterbacks all meet in the same room? Because if one of them gets it, I can't wipe out my entire depth chart. Mm. Well, forget about that. If one coach in college football gets it, do we see what happens, like what happened in the NBA? And that's it, if we're three games into the season, whatever. So, you know, the financial aspect, they all obviously want to play, but there's also that, well, if we do, it could also be an interrupted season.
Yeah, it's my biggest fear. You know, if things die down, that we see it come back and emerge somewhere in October and November, and what are we going to do after that? And this goes beyond like, oh, what are we going to do with games? To me, it's what are we going to do on who's infected and how are we going to respond to that, especially on a college campus? That's my biggest fear when we discuss this. Now, James Franklin brought up something this week when he was asked about the idea of certain states, and we've talked about this just now, and as well as on SportsCenter, where certain states, and it's down to the governors and the university presidents. But if we see potentially, 10 teams or 8 teams from a conference that where they're playing, they have their states are the green light and they're going to school and they could play while other states are shut down and they're still in the same conference. What kind of dilemma is that going to play out here potentially?
A huge dilemma. And it is a very real possibility as we follow what's unfolding right now nationally and politically as different states are doing different things. I mean, Mountain West Commissioner Craig Thompson was the one who said to me, what if the state of Louisiana can't play and Alabama can? You've got the defending national champs that can't practice and Alabama can. That's going to go over real well.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, it's not even conference to conference, like the Big Ten can and the SEC can't. it's state to state within your own conference. The ACC alone spans 10 different states. So that is a very real possibility. And it could be a decision that unfolds real time. But I think James Franklin mentioned to me what he was talking about was a scenario where you've got some top 10 teams that could be in contention for the college football playoff and they could play and other teams might not be able to. Well, you'd hurt your conference from a competitive standpoint, from a financial standpoint, if you said we all can't play because a couple can't play. But I didn't ask, and I should have, a follow-up question. Well, what happens if those top 10 teams can't play and Northwestern and Rutgers can?
Mm-hmm.
No, it's the truth.
Then what do you do?
Yeah, then what do you do? And then how do you look at the schedule and how can you look at conference play? Or do you start looking at who can play in the state with you or who can play state to state to reduce the travel? I mean, again, this is one of those things that you got to think outside the box. And then do you limit? And then when you talk about conference play, what does that do with Notre Dame? And how will, you know, Swarbrick take a look at that? And how can you complete a schedule here if these teams are going just conference to conference and they're playing within that conference?
So Notre Dame is really interesting because 10 of their 12 opponents are from Power 5 conferences, including two from the Pac-12, Stanford and USC, right? I talked to John Swofford literally 10 minutes ago, and he said that the ACC would be willing to keep the six games. They have six games already scheduled against Notre Dame this year to help them out and maybe add more. If it came to a situation where they were playing conference-only games, because Notre Dame and the ACC have a contractual agreement to play an average of five games a year against each other. This year they have six teams on there. So if they went to conference-only, if the Power 5 conferences decided to do that, I think the ACC would be in a position to help Notre Dame out with at least some of those games and maybe add more. But when you look at the game against Navy in Ireland, I don't know what you do there. I was on radio in Ireland, and the lady asked me, the host of the show asked me, well, what happens if the United States wants to play the game and Ireland doesn't? I was like, oh, I never thought about that. I guess they'd have to find another place here, but that's a great question.
Heather, after that, you're gonna say, I got to call, I've got to call all the diplomatic contacts that I have to reach somebody in the embassies to break this down, right?
Because exactly.
This is on a global scale. Go figure that we were talking about college football now in May on a global scale where two countries are trying to broker a deal to have maybe a Notre Dame
role. Right. Oh, my goodness. But it is. It is a national thing. I mean, when the college football playoff board of managers, the 10 FBS conference commissioners are on a call with the vice president of the United States, you know we're dealing with unique times here.
What's the role of the NCAA in all of this?
That's a great question. As a matter of fact, I emailed them to get Mr. Mark Emmert on the phone to ask him that very question.
Yeah.
Well, it's really fascinating because the NCAA put together this task force with Dr. Brian Hainline to help. And from what I understand, they are the different conferences are really more so doing their own thing than leaning on that group to help them make the decisions. It's something that I'm continuing to report. The Big Ten has their own task force. Bob Bowlesby told me that the Big 12 has hired some infectious disease experts out of Duke's University Hospital. John Swofford was just telling me that they're putting together a group of experts from each of their university campuses. So everyone's leaning on different people to get their medical advice because that's what this comes down to. They need to make decisions on something that is completely outside the realm of their expertise.
With the NCAA, it seems like not taking a front leadership role in this, it comes to another topic, and that is the Power Five and everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
Could you see the way this plays out in certain conferences like you know, the SEC says we're playing. The ACC follows, we're playing. The Big Ten says we're playing. How does that play out for everybody else outside the Power Five? And then we're talking about the Group of Five and the other conferences.
Right. I mean, that could certainly happen. I talked to SEC Commissioner Greg Sankey not too long ago and said, would you be willing to play if nobody else could? And he said, I don't have to make that decision right now. But he did say, remember when they decided to cancel the basketball tournaments as that was all unfolding that day? It's kind of a similar situation in that all of those Power Five commissioners are constantly talking to each other and communicating and trying to do things together. But if you remember, as they canceled the basketball tournaments, each conference made their own decision to do that individually, right? And I think that that is something that you might see again with those conferences in this particular situation. But at the same time, as they exist in regards to everybody else in the NCAA, remember that all of these universities make up the NCAA. I feel like the general public sometimes forgets that and has this image of a building in Indianapolis that operates as its own entity. And that's not how it works. The NCAA enforces the rules that all these Power Five commissioners and everybody else makes. I mean, don't forget, you've got the Football Oversight Committee. You've got the Transfer Working Group and Division of Infractions. Like, all of these other groups and committees and subcommittees are made up of people who come from all of those other conferences. So I think if we see anything and any help overarching on all this sport, it will come from the Football Oversight Committee as far as helping regulate any stop, start, rules, forfeits, that kind of thing.
Heather, I'm curious about one thing. We're playing the optimistic role here of, let's just say, fluid, and let's assume that we have some fall football. But we briefly brought it up about spring of 2021. And what have the commissioners, the ADs, and, you know, the coaches talked about the idea, if we have a spring football season, how does that play out with the draft? How does that play out with, you know, could you see a guy that's potentially a top 10 pick and he doesn't play in the fall and says, well, I'm 4 months away from the draft. Why in January am I going to play football and risk anything? Have you had any type of conversations like that about those scenarios where, you know, guys just start to say, you know what? I'm not going to play. We're just right around the corner from the combine. I'm just going to skip this out. I won't play spring football. I'm just going to get ready for the NFL draft.
Right. That's definitely a concern with pushing the season back. You know, it's this kind of fine line that you walk in thinking, we got to get a season in whenever we can get it. Let's do it. And we'll figure everything else out as it comes. And it's not just the timing of the draft as well, but also you could be having NCAA basketball tournament going on. You could be having Major League Baseball and NBA. We can go from 0 to 120 in a month and not have enough programming space for all of these things that could be happening.
I could tell you it'll be the greatest sports centers you'll ever see.
It would be wonderful. Like, it would be wonderful.
But it is a scenario where I look at, we want to see college football. We all love the sport so much. I want to see college football regardless this year if everybody's healthy. Right. But my biggest fear is what happens to the quality of play if they have to have a spring. And I want to have college football just also to save a lot of athletic departments and universities who need the money. But what kind of performances will we see if we see spring ball where we're losing maybe many of the stars that were supposed to be headlining this because they're looking for? And I would not blame any kid that says, I do not want to play this 2 or 3 month window from January to March because I got to get ready for the draft.
Right. And you also have to worry about the health of the players going into 2021. When do you finish with a bowl season and the CFP? And what exactly is the turnaround from the end of that spring season to, okay, time to kick off in August again, late August, right?
Yeah.
So that's a concern. And coaches have said to me, we don't want this to be a game of attrition, right? You know, to your point, and with health and with the quality of players and everything, everybody wants it to be at its best.
How are you holding up during all this? You know, there is a human side, and when you get the chance to talk to many of the presidents, and I mean the commissioners and the ADs and the coaches, how are you holding up? How do you think they're all holding up?
You know, I'm wondering who's doing the commissioner's day jobs, because their whole focus has really been so heavy on the coronavirus pandemic, as it should. But I mean, you know, they've got name, image, and likeness and all these other things that are going on that have kind of been on the back burner, but are still very important issues that they're dealing with as well. So I've got no complaints. I'm working. I'm doing, you know, kindergarten recycling and earth and fractions in the fourth grade. I mean, we got the barbershop, the landscaping, whatever you need in this house. We got it. So I got no complaints. My family's healthy. I'm working hard and life is good here in Maryland. But man, God bless everybody else who's out there struggling. And I really mean that. And, you know, we need sports as a distraction from the real world. And we don't have it right now. And it's hard.
Well said. And our best to the family and to your sanity. For any parent at home, they understand what I'm saying right now.
Yes, sir.
It's fantastic time with your kids, but there are no moments where you just sit there and just take a break. It is nonstop, and then you're wearing multiple hats. And the kids benefit; they're having a blast because hey, it's a home day every day. it's a home day, but I'm also your teacher today, you know,
at least
for 2 hours. My best to the family and the kids. And of course, thank you for joining us here. And hopefully the next time we have you back on, we're talking about even brighter news about the college football season.
Fingers crossed, my friend. Thanks for having me on.
You know, the 2020 draft is in the books, but the man never stops working. Great to have Mel Kiper Jr. Back with us here on the College Football Podcast. So we already got the 2021 big board out. I love it. You revealed it earlier this week where you took a look at the top 25 players. And, of course, things could change, but it's for college football fans. It gives them, I think, a chance to kind of see where their schools are stacked up with the talent. It gets them, I think, their juices flowing heading into the summer. And for me, Mel, it's a good conversation when it comes to the quarterbacks, because I think a year ago everybody said if Trevor Lawrence enters the draft, he'd be the number one pick, but he had to come back because he had to go for his sophomore season. And now he's number one on your big board, but there's another guy right behind him in Justin Fields at number three making ground. Let's just start talking about the quarterbacks here on your big board when you broke it down heading into 2021.
Yeah, it was interesting because you have Fields and Lawrence at the top, and they've been really 1 and 1A, Kev, since high school. So it's been kind of this recurring theme with Lawrence and Fields. It's going to continue all the way up until late April when we're in Cleveland to see which one of these two really emerges as the best quarterback of this group. And it's not a foregone conclusion that it's going to be Trevor Lawrence, because Trevor Lawrence at the end of the year had two games, which you would say he struggled. You say, well, he won the Ohio State game. Well, he did after he got that the hit on him by Sean Wade, and they called targeting, and Sean Wade was ejected, and then I give Trevor Lawrence a lot of credit. He showed his legs, his mobility, and all the versatility he has, and he brought them back. And then, of course, he had the struggles against LSU. But if he has a great year, Kev, it's going to be Trevor Lawrence. If he has a not a year from start to finish that you know he's capable of. And he does lose T. Higgins, but he's got Justin Ross stepping in as the go-to guy. He's got four starters they need to replace on that offensive line, so we'll see how that group holds up. But Travis Etienne's back at running back. Fields has a great supporting cast coming back, even though he doesn't have J.K. Dobbins and K.J. Hill and some others. But I think you look at Trey Lance, North Dakota State kid. Didn't really know where to put him. He only had 1 year as a starting quarterback. He's a third-year sophomore this season, but he was phenomenal. When you watched him, he was just so poised. 1,100 rushing yards, 67% completion percent, zero interceptions. So I put him in at 15. We'll see what happens there. And we want to see what the transfer from Wake Forest to Georgia, Jamie Newman, does. With all that talent, certainly gifted. He's got those young receivers now, will be sophomores. So I think he's one that could really make a nice choice. All Joe Burrow Burrow make a huge jump up. We saw it with Baker Mayfield. We saw it obviously with Kyler Murray. And now we see Jamie Newman, the quarterback of Georgia, first year there. We'll see if he does well, how far he moves up that draft board.
I'm glad you mentioned him. Pollock was super hype when he transferred from Wake Forest. And physically, when you look at him, you're like, whoa, okay. Help me understand this from your viewpoint, because Trevor Lawrence and Justin Fields, I'm fascinated. We're going to hear about this story for the next year, all that build up into the draft too, considering that these guys played 30 minutes away from each other in Georgia. They were the number one, number two recruits coming out of high school. Fields takes a different journey. He's not the golden boy at Georgia because he can't beat out Jake Fromm, so he transfers to Ohio State. The way the NFL continues to change, and when you look at Trevor, he is the prototypical quarterback that we have grown accustomed to watching and understanding that, hey, that is an NFL quarterback because of the way he's built and his arm strength. But the way that Justin Fields is right now, what we've seen with Lamar Jackson and Patrick Mahomes and the ability to move around, you could even say Marcus Mariota, and that's not a knock on Trevor Lawrence because Trevor can move around. What do you see with Justin Fields and the way the NFL's changed how they view quarterbacks in offense? In his rise here?
Yeah, I think it will be. I think the Mahomes evolution and how he's developed into the great quarterback he is coming out of Texas Tech when there were lots that had concerns about Mahomes. I wasn't one of them, thankfully, Kev, but there was a lot of negativity. People were questioning the Texas Tech offense. Nobody was raving about Patrick Mahomes leading up to that draft. You didn't hear a lot of that until after the fact. So, again, Justin Fields will benefit from that. We've seen others. Lamar Jackson and what he's meant. People weren't high on Lamar Jackson. He was the last pick in the first round. The Baltimore Ravens took a Hayden Hurst, a tight end who's now not even with the team. He's in Atlanta now, over Lamar Jackson. The league was thinking something like, well, he's going to be a receiver. They want him to work out there at the combine. So Brian Billick, my good friend, always said, Kev, there's no other position other than quarterback where we do revisionist history more. Everybody wants to act like 5-10 years down the road, everybody had this, everybody knew this. No, they didn't. They didn't know everything. They didn't have any of the answers that they had after the fact. It's like the Monday morning quarterback. You go to every game looked easy. If you had all the guys, I should have known that this team was going to win. You didn't, because that's why they play the game. So again, I think when you look at the quarterback position, Justin Fields has benefited from that, but he's a great player in his own right, Kev. He's right there with Lawrence, and I think it's going to be really interesting to see what type of season we have. Is the season go as a full season, a regular, like we expect, that we've always had, or is it a season interrupted? Does it start on time? What's the draft process like this year? You know, this year we didn't have many pro days, and they were complaining about that. What happens this year? The coronavirus is still out there. What type of season do we have? What type of draft process do we have will certainly impact these quarterbacks and everybody in this draft.
Let's go through the order here, the top 10 that you got out there with the big board. Lawrence, Penei Sewell, the big offensive tackle out of Oregon. Justin Fields, Jamar Chase, wide receiver out of LSU. Micah Parsons, the linebacker out of Penn State. Sean Wade, the cornerback at Ohio State. Patrick Surtain, the cornerback out of Alabama. Rashad Bateman, the wide receiver at Minnesota. And Marvin Wilson, the defensive tackle at Florida State. And Javon Holland, the safety there at Oregon. He's very versatile. When we look back at that 2020 draft, there's a variety of different storylines, but one of them that was, especially day one, that kept on, you know, I was bringing it up nonstop. You and I were talking about it nonstop on SportsCenter, was the wide receiver class. Where would you stack Jamar Chase, who couldn't come out this year? Where would you stack him up with that 2020 draft class?
You know, that's interesting, because going into last year, Jerry Jeudy was the guy. He had a super high grade. You know, he was just a spectacular player, and he drops. And, you know, here's Denver getting him where they did, you know, at pick 15. So that, to me, was a real bargain and a great pick. Jamar Chase had that 1 year so far. Remember, he wasn't a very productive player his first year. So that whole offense at LSU, Joe Brady comes in, Joe Burrow emerges, Clyde Edwards-Helaire starts for the first time. Remember, Nick Brossett was the running back ahead of Clyde Edwards-Helaire prior to that. Justin Jefferson had some inconsistencies, wasn't productive, and then he came on strong. Same thing with Chase. So all these guys came on. Okay, and Chase had that great year, and within 2 great years, then he will be right there. I mean, he's fourth on the board right now. Judy was way up there last year, so I would say that's an equal situation. So you say Chase and Judy, very, very similar, okay? Then you go to Rashad Bateman, and you think, okay, who was receiver last year, number two on the board? And number two on the board was CeeDee Lamb and Henry Ruggs III and those guys, right? Well, you got right there, you have another receiver that's rated very high in Bateman. You have Jaylen Waddle and Devontae Smith, both at Alabama. So two more Alabama receivers like we had this year. So that negates that. Justin Ross is probably going to be faster than T. Higgins, so he will be have a higher grade than Higgins. Chris Olave at Ohio State will have a very high grade. So right there you have 6 first-round caliber receivers. And I think that group, at the end of the day, could end up being better than this group. Because remember, Jefferson had that one great year, came out of really nowhere. And you think about what happened with the other receivers, how they slipped a little bit. Higgins, you know, even went first pick in the second round. Okay. Jalen Reagor jumped up into the first. So again, I think this group, these six, I think their grade may end up being either equal to or maybe even a little higher than this group after all was said and done.
What exactly do you look for when you watch these guys? For our audience, when they watch games, they're obviously, they're looking for certain things. What do you look for, especially this top 25 on your big board?
I think the main thing is, Kev, even when you're putting this together, is who makes plays? Who are the defense? And that's why even like a Tyler Shelvin from LSU, he didn't have the sack production, but he is such a dominant force along the interior. He just eliminates the run. He frees up other defensive linemen and linebackers to get after the quarterback, but his sack production needs to go up. Because the bottom line is, you gotta get 5-6 sacks as a defensive tackle. You gotta 4-5-6 sacks. You gotta be to that number. And if he does, he will even move up from where he is right now. And I have him at 17 because we haven't had that yet. So Sean Wade now becomes the lead guy. Remember, you know, at Ohio State, this is kind of DBU now. And now you have Arnett, you have Okuda, and four. Everybody's leaving. But Sean Wade's back. He's going to be the main entity in that secondary. So Patrick Surtain has to become like Marlon Humphrey was, a lockdown corner. All these things, you're just looking for guys to be, you know, great players. I mean, I just look for guys to make plays, whether it's receivers who get touchdowns. I always look for yards after catch. Offensive tackles. Penei Sewell's allowed 1 sack in 2 years. He could be the second, third pick in the draft. What type of production do we get? Javon Hollins had 9 interceptions the first 2 years at Oregon. Okay. Just until Trey Lance, second year now where we expect great production, the quarterback from North Dakota State. All these guys, Dylan Moses coming off of an injury. How does he perform? Okay. Linebacker, Alabama. Walker Little, left tackle, Stanford. How does he perform coming back from an injury? Both these guys were out all last year. So again, to the tight ends like Pat Freiermuth at Penn State and Kyle Pitts at Florida continue to be main entities in that pass offense. Gregory Rousseau had all those sacks at Miami of Florida. I thought some of them were coverage sacks. I'd like to see him improve his technique and have a little bit better get off at the line. We'll see what he does. So again, a lot of these guys gets more consistency. We want to see a jump up in production. And for some of these guys, put 2 great years back to back. I think that's what you're looking for, Kev. Not just 1 year, but 2 years. And in some of these cases, a little bit more sack production and a little bit better technique and just be better. Because another year from last year, these guys all should improve over what we saw.
You mentioned Kyle Pitts. I love that kid from Florida. He is outstanding, the tight end. There's another Kyle, though, in that offense. And I want to get your thoughts on him early on because – and you know where I'm going here.
Yes,
A year ago, no one was talking about Joe Burrow. And when you play for Dan Mullen in that offense, things could change a lot in your career. And Kyle Trask is one of those guys. He doesn't have a lot of experience. He came into the middle of last season, and he was building in that offense. When you see Kyle Trask, what do you see for him when it comes to talent on Sundays?
Yeah, it's funny you brought him up, Kev, because he was almost my fifth quarterback going in. I said, okay, Jamie Newman, you got to put him in there. And then Tanner Morgan, I just like the way he plays. And of course, he benefits from a lot of good running backs and wide receivers around him, but he's still a really good quarterback. So it was like, if I'd had a 5A, it would have been Kyle Trask. And he's one of those guys that, you know, with his size, you mentioned the ability to make all the throws. Kadarius Toney, if he's out there every week with Grimes and the receivers they have, that he do lose P. Ryan, who was is a really good back coming out of the backfield, but they have a stable there. You know, Pitts is a great tight end. There's no question about that. He's got receiving entities, even though he lost some. Van Jefferson being the main guy. But I just think, you know, with his arm talent and the way he sees the field and he should be better, yeah, that could be a guy. We're always looking for that guy to make that big jump up. And it wouldn't be a huge jump up because, like I say, he's at 5'5A right now. But certainly he's on the radar and everybody's going to be waiting to see you know, how he does, because he's one of the next group of quarterbacks that is not that far off. Like I said, there's four established. The fifth is kind of open. I think a lot of people think K.J. Costello at Mississippi State transferring from Stanford will do well. We'll see if Kellen Mond, Texas A&M, will improve. We'll see what happens with Sam Ellinger at Texas. But you're right. Kyle Trask has a chance with the talent around him, with his second year now, with that offense, to really be a guy that makes a significant jump up the board.
How do you view Sam Ellinger? Because he's such a curious prospect to me when you look at his size. The guy knows how to play and he knows how to win. But how do you view him when it comes to, hey, the measurements and how scouts would view his talent?
Well, I think is he the overachiever quarterback? I think that's where you've got Brennan Eagles is coming in there. You know, he loses Johnson and Duvernay, so they lose two really good players. Duvernay was so spectacular. And, you know, you look at getting Samuel Cosby back at left tackle is a big help. I thought he might come back, come out. He decided to go back. He could be, right now, you know, Cosby's in that group. He's at 12. I mean, you want to see what kind of year he has. He's a gifted athlete at that left tackle spot, so we want to watch him. But to your point about Ellinger, yeah, the arm strength. I think that's what you're gonna, is he Baker Mayfield? I mean, Baker's got a little bit more of a live arm. Ellinger throws with anticipation. He's an intuitive quarterback. He sees things. Tough kid. He hangs in there. You know, he's a versatile kid. He's just a winner. So I just want to see, does the arm strength improve this year? A little more velocity. Does the ball jump out of his hand a little bit better? Then you will draw comparisons because of the way he competes to Baker Mayfield. Baker was the number one pick. So again, Ellinger's not going to be in that, you know, stratosphere right now, but I think that's what we're all waiting to see. And then his Eagles and some of those receivers make up for the loss of two guys, particularly Duvernay, who had a gazillion catches, and he was a heck of a pick for the Baltimore Ravens. So we'll see on that. But Ellinger right now, I have him at 7 in terms of the quarterbacks. Yeah, he's, you know, like I say, 5 was the 5 we talked about, down to, yeah, to Lance, and then Tanner Morgan with Newman in there. Lance 3, Newman 4, and Morgan 5, and 5A, if you want to say 6, would be Kyle Trask. Then you have the K.J. Costello, Sam Ellinger, Kellen Mond, Brock Purdy at Iowa State. Those are some of the other quarterbacks that are kind of in that discussion to be the 5th or 6th quarterback in that draft.
Yeah, Purdy is fascinating to me because he can do so many things. You know, 13 rushing touchdowns. He's got a 6'1", 210 frame. Another guy that I've been trying to figure him out. It's very tough to do. And then what you look at the environment, you look at the his head coach. It's Ian Book at Notre Dame. How do you evaluate Ian Book there?
I think Ian Book, and I'm a big Notre Dame fan, Kev, as you know, and I watch them, I play back their games 3-4 times a week. Ian Book, is a guy, he's just a good college quarterback. I think as a backup in the NFL, that's what you're hoping maybe he can develop into. You know, he's not Jake Fromm. Look where Jake Fromm went, 5th round. Is he as good as Jake Fromm? No. His grade's not going to be as high. Jake Fromm went in the 5th round. He's going to be in Buffalo backing up Josh Allen. So again, you know, you look at these quarterbacks, Ian Book just to be a good college quarterback, which I think in a consistent week in and week out. He doesn't have great physical talent. We talk about with Ellinger, same type of thing there. Brock Purdy, is his arm going to be good enough in the NFL moving forward? Will that arm improve a little bit this year at Iowa State? So I think that's what we want to see. Do they have that ability to make all those throws, tight windows, all the things you need to do in the NFL? And it's the same exact thing for Ian Book. Right now I have him at 9 in terms of the quarterbacks. He has the same grade as the 15th quarterback. So he's in that mid-round, late-round type of guy. But like I said, when you say mid to late rounds, that means undrafted, because Jake Fromm had a second, third-round grade going in. He had a first-round grade going into last year, and then he dropped to a second, third-rounder, and he lost all that talent around him. He becomes a fifth-round draft choice. So these quarterbacks, you can see, look at Morgan from Florida International, went in the 4th round ahead of Jake Fromm. So it's pretty amazing. Jalen Hurts goes in the 2nd round. So it kind of got a little crazy at the end, the way things kind of flip-flop. But in terms of this year, I think the story is going to be, Kev, two things. It's going to be Lawrence and Fields battling it out. Well, three things. I might even go to four after I keep talking here. But you got Trey Lance is going to be a big story coming out of North Dakota State, because we already saw Carson Wentz go number two in the draft out of that same program. And they got a lot of talent there, and they win all every year. So you got the two battling out. Lance as the wild card. Jamie Newman as that transfer who could really do well at Georgia. Then you get down to who emerges as that fourth, fifth quarterback of the guys we talked about. And like I said, it's not only Morgan, at the Minnesota, there's the other guys you mentioned. There's also not just Newman transferring, it's Costello transferring from Stanford to Mississippi State. So I want to see, how this quarterback class emerges, but I think the big storylines are right at the top. Three huge storylines that we're going to be following all year.
Good stuff, Mel. Before we let you go, I think the audience, I'm curious about this. You don't just go hibernate now. Like, what's next for you as you catch a little bit of a break here after your tremendous work with the draft?
Here's what we do, Kevin. I think Todd's this way as well. And by the way, Todd is feeling better. I'm going to hopefully have him come on the Daria Mel show maybe next week. I'm going to talk to Todd hopefully today. But thankfully, he is feeling better, coming off what he battled for that whole month. But I think when you look at what we both do, and Todd and I talk about this a lot, you come off of the long year, because our year goes really from August until May. And then you say, okay, May becomes reviewing. Todd always hates when we'll be in day three, and I'll just put the list of my guys for his mock draft. I'll say, here's a couple guys, and I'll just throw it. He'll run up and throw it at me. And I go, shut up with that next year stuff, right? So we always got to kid him about that. But that's what we do. We start throw the big boards out. You got to look at these players, Kev. So I'll spend a week or so after the draft and getting all that geared up. But I'm also doing that a little in April. So I spend maybe an hour of my day when I'm getting ready for the draft in April to look at next year's guys, which is crazy, but you got to do it, Kev, because I can't just throw names out there. I got to look at these players. So you got to look at these guys, study these guys, knowing you only have a week or two right after the draft to even have a chance to focus on it. So you want to get a head start on that. So that's what I do. Now I'll spend the rest of May looking at these same guys for next year. June, I'll take a 2-3 week break to not talk football, not do anything football related, nothing. In fact, I love baseball, so I always watch baseball, go to some Oriole games, whatever it may be. Well, I don't know when we'll have baseball this year, but that's normally in a normal year, that's what I'd be doing. And then July, start to gear up for the first big board for next year, actually in August, and just get ready. But I always think June is the month you got to regenerate. You can't talk football, you can't watch football, you can't be around anything football related. You need, I think, all of June's got to be a month to just get away and then do other things and not watch any prospects, not watch any football, and then it really gets you fired up for July and August, because you haven't done it for a month now, saying, boy, now I miss it, now I want to get back to it. So I think we all need to take a break at some point from what we're doing, and June for me is that month.
And you recharge and you're refreshed and ready to go. But in between that time in June, though, you're still consistently having the pumpkin pie, though, right? That's still part of the diet?
That's inconsistent, though. What happened during this, Kim started making pumpkin pies, and I always had refused to eat her pumpkin pies, not because I didn't think they were good, as I always had. Yeah. The Safeway brand is what I like. Well, I haven't been going up to the store, so Kim said, I'm going to start. She makes phenomenal pumpkin pies. I missed out for 31 years on Kim Kuyper's pumpkin pies, because I'm a stubborn idiot. So she's made phenomenal pumpkin pies every day. She's made two last night. I already had half of one today already to get ready for your podcast with you, Kev. Just get my pregame meal was half of a pumpkin pie. So there you go. But no, that will continue through the summer and all the way through now. Normally I take a little break in the summer because they don't really have pumpkin pies when it's hot up there for whatever reason. But now that Kim's a specialist in pumpkin pies, I think I will not take a break from the action, and I will have them through the summer.
And what I find incredible, though, is 31 years you've been going with somewhere else. But I admire your consistency that you know what you like, and you're just going to go to that well every single day with the Safeway pumpkin pie. But it was underneath your nose the entire time. The pumpkin pie specialist,
Kev,
is Kim.
Kev, let me tell you something. Todd always says, you're crazy. You're crazy. Everybody that knows me at some point will say I'm crazy. Okay, I'm a little off center somehow along the way. I don't know what happened, Kev, along the way, but I don't deal way ever. I don't know what you want to call it, but Todd, if you ever want to ask who can describe me the best outside of my wife, it would be Todd McKay. We're always together doing something. So ask Todd about Kuiper, then he'll give you his scouting report. And I guarantee you, one of the things, one word will pop up numerous times when he's talking about me is crazy.
Yep. Man, well, we're crazy for you, and you're the best. And listen, acceptance is the first step, right, in any process. So, Mel, we appreciate it. Rest up. Enjoy June, and hopefully you get to see some Orioles games in July the way this thing is going. Hopefully, no matter what, though, most importantly, we hope you and Kim and the family are healthy and safe. And I'm glad you brought up Todd because our thoughts are with him as he recovers. And by the way, for anybody listening to this podcast, I suggest listening to the Adam Schefter podcast with Todd. He reveals what he went through, and it's just good to see him that he's back. And honestly, like we missed a couple of those Todd Zingers. You're going to get it in the podcast. You're going to feel like, oh, okay, McShay's back a little bit. And that's a great thing. So, Mel, enjoy the offseason, and thank you for joining us.
Anytime, Kev. You're the best, pal. Appreciate it, man.
That'll do it here for the College Football Podcast. Big thanks to Mel Kiper Jr., who's been fantastic the last couple weeks joining us, and I love hearing his pumpkin pie stories. Heather Dinich, we love having her on as she gives us the pulse of the college football world with daily updates on SportsCenter to understand what commissioners as well as coaches and ADs are going through and the hope and belief that we could have a college football season. And once again, our thoughts are with Todd McShay as he recovers to good health for him and his family. Taylor Schwenk, our producer, shout out to him. He does a fantastic job to make sure we are smooth show here every time we're on with you guys. And for you guys, the listener, in the coming weeks, we will have more insiders as well as college coaches giving us their perspective as they deal with the virus and also try to get ready for a college football season. Until then, we wish you good health and safety for you and your family. Thank you.